So today's reading text for my comments, with which I used to frame these comments, is one of my favorite from Curtis Rees, who was a religious humanist scholar who lived in the early 20th century and had some teaching responsibilities as an adjunct at Harvard Divinity School, and a great leader in the movement of religious humanism, which was kicked off in the late 19th century and really took off in the 20th century. And he uses this word liberalism at the beginning of this comment that is really an interesting word because it's been packed since his time with so many different connotations. It's been painted as a bad word. It's been painted as something that's in opposition to conservatism. But when he was talking about liberalism, he was talking about the spirit of generosity. He was talking about the spirit of open inquiry. He was talking about remaining open to questions and all sources of knowledge and understanding for how we live our lives and to keep pursuing those. And this particular statement actually has a lot in common, you'll recognize, with the notion of Buddhist impermanence. And I think I've been especially in touch with things like Elaine's illness and Lynn's fall with impermanence the last couple of weeks. So this came to me to talk with you about today. Read it with me. Liberalism affirms in terms unmistakable that institutions are only the tentative and temporary expression of personality, that they are frequently outgrown and must, like the hull of a chrysalis, be burst asunder and left only to mark an epic past. Institutions, religious, capitalistic, socialistic, or whatnot, must stand or fall as they are able or unable to serve effectively and efficiently in the building of free and positive human souls. So if there's one way to frame our commitment to compassion, justice, and sustainability, it is in this way, which is we do this in order to serve effectively and efficiently in the building of free and positive human souls. And a measure of an institution, a measure of a state, a measure of a leader, I would propose to you, is in just how devoted these people, these groups, these organizations are to fulfilling this particular calling. And if you use this measure in discerning what's right and what's wrong in our world today, it will help you go a long way in doing that. Now, I've been thinking a lot about young people, too, the last couple of weeks. For some reason, I've been thinking about young people. Perhaps it's because we had the Tea for Sages in our fellowship a few weeks ago. How many of you came to that? Anybody here went to the Tea for Sages? Yeah, there are three or four sages here. Yeah, welcome. Glad to have you. It was for people over 80. We had 16 folks show up for the tea. It was great. It was a great time. It was good to remember together and to celebrate together the beauties and joys of life and the life we share together. Maybe that made me also think of just how I get old and where I came from as a young person, and you can do the same as well. Perhaps it was what made me think about young people more was a dinner party. It keeps coming back to me. This happened last year toward the end of the year. I was at a dinner party, and there was a young man a little over age 30 who said to me, "I can't wait for all baby boomers to die. They are the cause of all the problems on our planet. And as soon as they're out of the way, we're all going to be better." Well, I didn't want to disabuse him of that notion. I think generation after generation has tried to search for particular people to blame for a human condition that drives us to points of despair and depletion, to living lives based on scarcity and fear rather than lives based on a sense of trust and faith and fulfillment of our relationships with ourselves and with one another. Perhaps it was because of the young woman whose slide was at the beginning of the service, Greta Thunberg. How many of you know who Greta Thunberg is? Not many. Greta is 16 now, but she spoke this last year to the United Nations. She's Swedish. She's a climate activist. And she's organized international school walkouts saying, look, you guys, we're inheriting a world that's messed up. And you've left us to clean it up. Help us out here. Help us out here. Help us make it better. And of course, this is a hard time of transition. As population continues to grow, as fewer and fewer people enjoy great wealth and power at the expense of many people who are suffering more and more. These kinds of themes had me thinking about the kind of world that my children and my grandchildren are going to see. And that's been sobering. It has also called me to have faith, to trust in the process, that we can, as a species, overcome our propensity to be reactive and greedy in the moment and sacrifice the future for short-term gain. I see the younger people today, my children included, saying, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And they inspire me. They inspire me. So people like Colin Vail and others who are coming up as luminary leaders, Brandon McGinnis last week, who built the beautiful garden bed outside, out front, with other Boy Scouts as a part of his Eagle Scout project. All of these kinds of things inspire me and give me hope. And I hope they give you hope too and help you sustain your faith into the future. And then maybe it's because I had a dream on this same theme. And it was a couple of weeks ago. And some of us have been talking about dreams. And so I'm outing myself here. I'm a person who listens to my dreams when they seem to make sense or seem to be important. And this one stayed with me. And the dream was, I was gathered with many of you out here in the fellowship area, in the congregational area. There were no chairs in the room, and we were all standing together in a community, and all of the young people in our community, about 30 or 40 young people, children all the way up through high school, were standing up here on the chancel. And all of us together were saying to them, okay, we're going to hand this off to you now. This is your place. We've built it for you. We've wanted you to have it. And we want you to find your own sense of what it takes to be a free and positive human soul through whatever we've done here and whatever we've provided for you. Now, that was a powerful dream. And I woke up from it, and it stayed with me, and it stayed with me to today. And it is true that we're in a time of transition in our fellowship. As Katie Boskoff said, we're 31 years strong. Many of the people who came here who were young, like Sandy when he showed up, and he's still young, but, you know, we're a little, got a little gray, you know, yeah. So we've had a consistent staffing since Ned White came. It's been beautiful. We've had consistency in the staffing as Sandy pointed out, that's been very helpful to this congregation. And there's a deep sense of being entrusted with the well-being of this congregation, the part of all the staff members. And we have a great staff team. And we do a lot with very little, and we're so grateful to be doing it. It just is a very meaningful place for us to be. And then we've had over 11 years of involvement in the Interfaith Shelter for the Homeless. Six we've served as a host site. We're coming into our seventh year here. This is our staff team out by the Peace Pole. The Peace Pole was a wonderful project that our congregation put together with the help of people like Connie Henry and Gwen Baldwin and other folks like that. So we're grateful for all these things. And our mission continues to challenge us individually and collectively. You know, we've had times of outreach, times of public witness, and this was one of them this last year where we stood on behalf of the Parkland school shooting survivors, and what they were trying to do. And we said, we're here for you. Let us know how we can help, and supported them in the challenges they faced and trying to say to our nation's leaders, look, the problem is you're not loving us. You're not being loving people. You're not creating a loving nation. This is what we want. We want you to love us. You need to love us. That's what we're talking about when we say we want guns controlled. We want people who are going to be shooters to be taken care of before they become shooters, mostly young white males of a young age who are disaffected without parents or without fathers, people who are suffering from mental illness, these kinds of things. We need a world in which everyone has a place and everyone is repeatedly affirmed as having a place. And so we do our little part like this sort of thing. We also, this last year, some of us marched with 300 clergy down the beach to the border wall, and we were faced with the full riot gear in the Border Patrol there. Jack Shue and I were there. And, you know, it was chilling. It was chilling to be a part of that and to see what was going on there. There was some dishonest stuff done there. We came in peace. One of the people who was helping to organize was standing back behind the line of encroachment. You can see it's very clearly demarcated there. And after a while, some of the Border Patrol people realized this person is one of the leaders of the organization. So they rushed across the line of demarcation into the crowd. They grabbed him and dragged him back across. And then they told the media that this man had assaulted an officer. And he disappeared for 24 hours, and he only got out, I'm convinced, of detainment, without being charged for anything, because their bluff had been called by 300 people who called them ahead of time and said, we know you're lying. We have a witness. This man here, Jack Shue, a member of our congregation, is a retired peace officer. He was standing right next to him. He saw everything that happened. He said, I'll be a witness. I'll stand up and tell him. And once they found this out, they just sort of let him go, didn't charge him with anything. But I'm convinced that if we had not called, he might still be gone. Who knows what would have happened in terms of his own detainment. So we're trying to stand for justice. And this community, as every spiritual community can be, is a source of strength to those of us who go out and march, go out and demonstrate and say to our leaders, look, you're not being loving. You're not being loving. Love us. Love the world. Love the people who come to us seeking asylum. Love the people who come to us in need. Love the people who we've actually helped as a nation put into the circumstances in which they live and which drive them to come to us seeking help. So that's another thing. And then we have some other things we've done. People have asked about the tiny house that we built. We built a tiny house starting in 2011, and the tiny house has now gone to Southern Arizona. It's on tour now, and it was this last weekend featured at the Tucson Festival of Books, which draws 130,000 people from across the country and around the world. And they got to talk about Henry David Thoreau and his small cabin. They used some books to illustrate that. They put out some stuff on the web page. And so the members of the Baja Four, which the four congregations of Southern Arizona have dubbed themselves, were there to present the tiny house, and thousands of people saw it, went through it, really started thinking about voluntary simplicity, thought about independent individual uses of green technology, these kinds of things. So it's going out into the world as everything we do does. Everything we do ripples out in some way or another. Sometimes it's not very visible. Sometimes we may think, oh, that didn't make a difference. But I tell you, everything you put out there, everything, somehow influences the world around us. And this is one of the ways in which we can take a great deal of pride. And of course, a couple of weeks ago, we had the Compassion for African Villages service, and we celebrated this partner organization with us. It is helping people in Liberia and Kenya and Zimbabwe and other places, after just getting a small start, sending 80,000 textbooks to Liberia that would be thrown away and burned otherwise. You know, helping people build latrines and public facilities and schools and these kinds of things. We have members of our congregations, like Ellie has been involved, and some others of you have been involved with Compassion for African Villages. And we're pleased to have these kinds of partner organizations that we're working with to actually amplify our capacity as a small community to do big things in the world. And of course, the internal life of the community is important. We have a lot of people here who gather around throughout the week in covenant groups and other places. And people, I'm encouraged by the fact that people are continuing to find here a meaningful place for personal refuge and healing relationships and stimulation for spiritual growth. It's one of the most gratifying things about my work is to come into contact with these kinds of things happening. But there are some new challenges facing our community as well. Oh, also, yeah, we're involved in Pride every year, so we are a welcoming congregation for anyone, including members of the LGBTQIA community. And we've had our parasol team marching in the Pride Parade every year. People who are straight, gay, cisgendered, transgendered, all sorts of people gathering together to celebrate the wonderful diversity of life and to honor the fact that no human being deserves to be excluded or judged just because of whom they love or because of the way in which they identify themselves. So, there are some challenges facing our summit community as well. The founders and older members of our fellowship are aging and increasingly unable to carry our institution as they have before. We're feeling that. Economic stresses are weighing more heavily than ever before on our members and friends, those with fixed incomes who can't find work, and on younger people who don't have the career opportunities that many of my generation and older folks had in the past. I think back, I have 3 master's degrees and a PhD. Okay? I would not have any of those probably today if I were a young person age 18 today. And the reason, one of the primary reasons for that is that I had work opportunities, but more importantly, when my stepfather died, I had a Social Security benefit that paid for part of my college education. It helped me see my way through college. It was a wonderful benefit. And so I got all the way through 3 master's degrees without accumulating any sort of educational debt. And today, it doesn't matter. If you go to school, you're going to be in debt, most likely, unless you have wealthy parents. So I look back and I see how many different opportunities I had as a white male, but also as a person just living in a different age, whose country had a sense of how important it was to support everyone, to support veterans with their health care needs, to support causes and systems that would prevent people from being homeless or mentally ill on the streets. All these kinds of things have evaporated since I was young. And so we live in a much different world, a much harsher world for many people. And I'm not sure I would have made it today. And there are ideological and socioeconomic forces at work that are preventing good people from realizing their fullest potential. You know, these forces are actually encouraging the spread of poverty, and with poverty goes ignorance and poor self-esteem and all kinds of problems that prevent people from being able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. If we're honest about it, none of us do that. We've all been helped along the way. We've all been helped along the way in some way. And these ideological forces that are at work seem to be aimed at indenturing as many people as possible in order to feed the unquenchable appetites of those at the top of the economic food chain. And this is a big problem, folks, and it's only going to get worse unless we can, with people like Greta Thunberg and other young people who are stepping out, people in the Poor People's Campaign that I'm a part of. I was a part of a webinar last week. I was the only person there with gray hair. Everybody was under 30, and they were saying, let's go out. Let's go out and change the system. Let's go out and change the world. Let's confront our leaders with the message. We want you to love us. We want you to love the world. Make that your priority. Make that your priority. In light of all this, the good as well as the problematic, I invite us to consider that this year's pledge drive is not simply about funding our operation for the next year. It is an important step in my preparation, your preparation, our preparation, to hand over this place and all that it stands for on to the next generation of leaders and world builders. Sages, we sages, as we move into sagehood, we're no longer world builders. We're there to provide support, encouragement, advice, however we can. But the activists, the people who are going to build the world to come, are people who have more energy than we do. People who have a greater vision of what would work and what would be necessary. And we need to be attentive to that and honor that and stand together as we hand that on to the people who come after us. We're all ancestors in training, even the young people. But we're at a particular place, many of us in our training, where it's time to step up and act like ancestors, good ancestors. To embrace the world, to bring what we are calling other people to do, to love the world, to love one another, to love ourselves more fully and completely as we can. And this is a major reason why I pledge this year, because I'm seeing it as an opportunity to pay it forward, to give ahead. And I hope you will think long term. This is not just about paying the staff for the next year. This is about giving what we have discovered here, what we have explored here, to the future in a way that can be helpful, in a way that can be resourceful, in a way that can be meaningful, a way that can hold promise for a world yet to come. As we boldly move into the new frontier of another fiscal year, new frontier theme came from our Star Trek skit last week. How many of you saw that? You know, I was dressed up here like Captain Kirk, although I called myself Captain Quirk, and we had Dr. Mary Bonecrusher, and we had Linda Officer Administrator Speck instead of Spock. It was kind of cute and quite humiliating. But this is what our theme was for this year. We're looking toward a future that's yet unknown. We're going into an undiscovered country, and it's time for us to really take stock and to pull our resources together to do it. Another one of my dreams, is that we will pay off our mortgage. We only owe $300,000 on a $1.1 million mortgage. And that's wonderful. That's wonderful. If we could pay that off, we would set free another $25,000 a year to be used in other kinds of programming. So that seems to me to be an important economic goal that we could set for ourselves. We don't have the means to have a capital funds campaign, but there are people in our congregation who do have the means to help us reach that goal if you want to. So that's one of my dreams that will help us hand this place off to the future. And we also want to explore and develop new forms of ministry and community in our fellowship. We'll probably need to do that. In effect, things that will represent a breaking of the hardening cocoon of past traditions, to draw on this imagery provided by Curtis Reese. You know, we tend to get into our way of doing things and think that things should always be done the same way and that they'll always be done the same way, and that's a recipe for success and stability. Well, it may be a recipe for stability, but it's also something that's going to lead us to death. If we don't actually open to the hardening of the cocoon inside, where the caterpillar becomes goo. Did you know that? The caterpillar just turns into this massive goo inside of a chrysalis. It's undifferentiated mush. And then somehow, miraculously, it reforms. And the cocoon breaks open. And out comes, well, you know. You know what comes out. Perhaps this will lead us, some of us, to engage in more collective living arrangements, like I did when I was a young person, and require that we build even stronger communal bonds for harder times that may yet come. Most certainly, it will mean giving ourselves to doing whatever it takes to build strong partnerships, like we have already, with more individuals and communities who might be new or unfamiliar to you and me. Perhaps it will mean very different configurations of paid ministry and staff. Who knows? Things are changing. The old forms will break apart. That's always the case. Just as you and I will break apart, and something new will come forth. Our mission, to bring compassion, justice, and sustainability to ourselves and the world, is bold. It's worth lifelong dedication, and it is possible. It is possible. It is possible. It just seems impossible, like Mandela said, until it's done. Until it's done. It perpetually calls each of us this mission to think beyond our comfortable enclaves, to keep stepping out of our comfort zones, and to take the wise and sometimes uncomfortable perspective of those who share responsibility for what happens to future generations and to this earth, this habitat that has sustained us so well.